what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, even Bentley Benz. But you moving kinda fast. Keep sweats, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.
Welcome to Time Out. I am your host, Sylvia Crawley Milbury, and tonight we have an interesting show lined up for you. First of all, I just want to say happy Labor Day to everyone, and hopefully you're enjoying your day off and taking advantage of the Labor Day sales. And I'm actually working on Labor Day, but I don't consider what I do work. I consider this a great opportunity and actually ministry. Tonight, I have with me writer and actor Rebecca Horan. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I just want to jump right into your story. You grew up with both your parents. You had two siblings, and you are actually from Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. Tell us what it was like growing up in New Jersey.
Well, I grew up around the shore, around the beach. I had a very supportive family. My mother was a teacher at the local school, at the school that I went to, and both of my siblings went to. And my father, he was also a teacher at and had his own masonry business. And so it was just a very practical family. Went to church on Sundays. Spent quality time together. It was just a very good family unit.
Okay. So you actually had your time out moment as early as 4 years old. Can you explain to us about that particular time of your life?
Yes. When I was at that age, growing up in the town that I grew up in, a family friend actually ended up molesting me and abusing me. And from that moment on, I kind of spiraled into, at the age of 7, very young age, into an eating disorder. And that's kind of where my first time out moment was, and kind of hitting that raw point and not knowing as a young child how to deal with what was on my plate at that time. Growing up in the good family that I had grown up in, it did not make sense, even for the issues that I would have with struggling with life-controlling issues like that as an eating disorder at that age. It did not make sense for the family that I grew up in.
Right. So did you tell your family right away that you had been molested, or did you, you know, were you threatened? Were you afraid to tell them? What was the situation there?
I was absolutely terrified. At the same time, I didn't know how to articulate or even process what was going on at a small child at that age. I just knew that it wasn't right at the same time, but I didn't feel like I could tell my family because it was a family friend, because of the things that were happening. And it just, from there on out, it was just like walking on eggshells. It was like this double life almost. It was like I had to cover up what happened, and I felt so much shame, like it was my fault, like it was, like I should have prevented it. I should have spoken up. If I hadn't been there, then I wouldn't have had that happen to me, or that I deserved it, or, you know. So all those things were going through my 4-, 5-, and 6-year-old mind, still developing and not knowing how to place that all together.
So how did that affect you in terms of your relationships with other kids at school? Did you tend to withdraw from other kids because you had the secret that you were carrying, or that you continue on with your normal personality?
At that point, I pretty much blocked it out from there on out, honestly. I just went on normally as a child that had gone through that could, and just blocked it out. And I was fearful, but I just went on as normal. You know, when you're right. that age, you kind of, you learn your principles, you know, of what is kind of normal, and that's just what happened. And I didn't know how to express all the emotions that I was feeling, and so, you know, even the eating disorder at that point was a way to kind of express pain and express things. And later that, even as I grew up, I turned that emotional pain and trauma either inward, or I would use it to fuel the activities that I was in, and the perfectionism that I was in to try to cover it up. But interacting with other children, it was just, I find that maybe I had more compassion with other children because mm-hmm. I had known a degree of things that I shouldn't have at that age. And so it would almost mm-hmm. make me feel that I was a little more grown up, I guess, than children. And not knowing, because no other child had experienced sexuality in that way. And so knowing that at that point just kind of propelled me into deeper things to kind of deal with the emotional pain of it, later into self-harm and to drug abuse.
We're
going to
get into that in just a minute. So
yes.
Your eating disorder, which eating disorder was it? Were you bulimic or anorexic? Which one did you?
When I was that age, I was bulimic. I would not eat as much, I suppose. I would try not to eat as much and try to control that. I suppose it had a lot to do with how my will had been broken, and so I wanted some semblance of control, and that was an automatic way to do it, and just to prove that I had a will, that it did. And so so at that age, it was bulimia, it was binging and purging, and that was kind of a way to express emotionally what I couldn't articulate in words.
Wow. So when you're 7 years old, 8 years old, and even 9 years old, your parents aren't really thinking that this is an eating disorder. They're thinking that you're a kid who doesn't want to eat. So maybe you're filling up on sweets and maybe you're drinking your juice before you eat. So were your parents trying to make you eat? Were they fighting against this eating disorder?
No, they had no idea whatsoever, at least until I was in my teenage years.
If you didn't want to eat, they just didn't make you eat, and you just didn't eat that day.
I would eat if they pressed me to, and then that's when I would purge my food. So that's kind of how life went.
Right, but there were days where they didn't press you; they just let you get up from the table.
Yeah.
Okay, so around the time when you were 12. You started drinking heavily. Talk about mm-hmm. that period of time of your life.
At that period of time, my brother, my family, they didn't drink at all except my brother when he got into his teenage years. But I wanted to try it. I really did. I didn't exactly even know what it was, but I knew that if I tried it, then, you know, it might make me kind of disconnect a little bit more and even kind of numb the pain. And that's kind of what happened. I was always just wanting to try that and be in that kind of adventurous way. And so I did at that age, and which was a totally clash with the friendships that I was in at that time. I was going to church. I was friends with people that loved Jesus, really. And so that actually pushed further into my exile of friendships at that time and into further isolation, but that's kind of where it went. And from there on out, I chose to drink at 12 years old, and that continued just on and on and on up into high school. So,
right. So what kinds of things were you drinking? I mean, what did you have access to as a 12-year-old? Was it just liquor that was around at your house or a friend's house?
Yes, it was just at my house and around my friend's house and in their parents' stash or whatever they had at their house. And so that's kind of where it began.
Now, you actually played sports. You played softball and you were on a swim team. So at what age did you start playing sports?
Oh, since I was a very young child. And, you know, it started with T-ball, and then up into that, I would just I played soccer and volleyball and basketball, and I was continuing to play up in all the way up until college. And so I would be playing sometimes four.
So softball, you started playing at what, seventh grade, sixth grade?
Softball started in about second grade.
Okay,
yeah.
So you started really early.
Yes,
so how does the eating disorder and the drinking addictions, how is that affecting you in terms of sports?
In terms of sports, I really don't even know how I survived some of the things and just continued walking in life in some even semblance of normality. I really do not. And I just accredit that to the grace of God in upholding me, but I kind of grieve over it now a little bit because I see how much further I could have gone if I didn't do those things with my body and if I had really
mm-hmm.
performed to my fullest without those things. And I'm a little grieved over it now, but seeing that, so it did affect my performance in some way because sometimes I would be sluggish, sometimes I would be sleepless, and then I would be either hungover or strung out later in life when I was getting into harder things. And it just, even I remember going to pitching practice one day later and passing out, you know, because I was malnourished, because I did not have the energy to do it, and trying to continue in quite futility, honestly. So,
wow. I can't even imagine. If I've missed lunch or one meal during the day, it was hard for me to complete 40 minutes of a basketball game. So I can't even imagine being bulimic or having a drinking addiction and, you know, trying to compete in sports. And, you know, softball's in the sun. You know, you're outside in the hot sun doing this. So, okay, so by age 16, you were arrested for selling and using drugs. Talk about that timeout period of your life.
Oh, man, that's when it all started coming down. It really did. Up until that point, I had pretty well hidden, you know, this double life that I'd been living with drinking and drugs, and at least from my closest family. And so my parents still hadn't known about that. But I'd gotten into drugs in high school. And in order to either pay or get into the social circles that I could get alcohol even at that age, I would hang out with a much older crowd. And so I started selling drugs in my high school. It was just like any other thing. It was so normal to me and to my high school and the school that I grew up in. And I mean, on the bus I'd be selling, and that's even where I first bought my first drugs. It was on the bus and going back and forth to school. And so that's kind of what happened. And I ended up, someone that I had sold to ended up getting caught with drugs on the school property, and she ended up telling where she got it from, and then they searched my stuff and found paraphernalia, and then they landed me for selling. So that's kind of what happened. I was suspended. But even then, in light of that, I guess because of my activity in sports and the way that I excelled, they would still allow me such grace, I guess they would call it, I would come and play softball. I wouldn't go to school some days, and I would just show up for the games. And that's kind of what life looked like for me because I was athletic and I was good at what I did, and my grades were good, my grades were fine, and so they couldn't fault me in those places. And so that's kind of how life continued, and surprisingly.
So when you got suspended from school, obviously your coaches found out why you got suspended. It was for selling and using drugs. Did your coaches, I mean, I know you said you excelled in sports, but was there ever a time when your coaches sat you down and said, hey, Becky, what are you doing here?
Actually, one of my coaches, my swim coach, was actually one of the school counselors, guidance school counselors, and he would have called me in and just asked me what was going on, but at that point, I was so shut off to even hearing anything remotely about advice, especially from men, especially because of my past. And at that point, at the age of 16, I'd gone through some really traumatic things and been in more physical abuse at that time, and had even at that age had an abortion and been in horrific relationships. And so at that point, I was not open. I was completely guarded from anything the world wanted to give me, any help, even in counseling. I didn't want to share my story. I didn't even open about the trauma that I experienced at that at young age until I was 19 years old. And so,
right.
So my coaches did try to reach out, but yes.
Right. So now your parents, obviously, like, who bailed you out of jail? Was that your parents?
Yeah, my my mother came and picked me up, and so.
So now she knows that, you know, you are into drugs, and, you know, was there ever a time where was this an opportunity for you to confide into her what you were feeling emotionally?
A little to a degree, but it wasn't enough at that point. I think with the kind of circumstances that I was still, I wasn't ready. I wasn't quite ready, honestly, to lay it down, to, you know, and, yeah.
Okay. So you said that at 16 you also had an abortion. So so talk about this obviously is a timeout period where, you know, you get pregnant, you're in sports, you're carrying a child, you're carrying the secret along with all the other secrets. Talk about that particular time.
I was in a relationship. I could not envision having a child at that point. I don't even know how. I was thinking, how is my body even going to handle this? Like, at the way that I was just driving it, I would, you know, and so to the point where I would just be drunk every day, and, you know, at that time of my life, I hardly even remember very much of what I was doing, because I was on something or some kind of substance at all times at that point for at least that whole year when I was 16. And so just doing that and having all those pressures and those secrets, it just, it broke me. And it was like, okay, well, why not this one more thing? Like, if it's going to add to my list of kind of mess ups, you know, it was just such a horrific period in my life, and I couldn't even see a way out of it. And to add that to the things that I was already walking through, I don't even, in my 16-year-old mind, I couldn't imagine anything like that. And so I went and I got the abortion, and I even, you know, tried to confide in the person that I was with at that time, and it just crushed me emotionally. It was like I stuffed it so deep back into my heart, because there's so much pain and so much angst at my own self at that time. And actually, the eating disorder got worse because of the shame that I had. And the self-harm got worse from that point because of the shame that I had. I felt like I couldn't come to anyone. I couldn't even come to God, because I had blood on my hands at this point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was just a really deep and pressing part of my life. And I, you know, and that was, I'm sad, so.
Wow, did you go to a clinic, or did you just kind of go to someone locally in the neighborhood?
I just went locally in the neighborhood. I'm afraid.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back in just a minute with some more of your timeout moments.
If you're into fantasy sports, you're going to love the Fantasy Sports Show with host Victor Gardner and co-host Jerry and Black every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern, featured at blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. This show is so hot, I can only play the intro.
Fantasy sports and politics.
You can also visit fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com for archives, advertising, and other information. The Fantasy Sports Show. Information, motivation, variety.
You are here with listening to Rebecca Horan, and this is Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. If you were just tuning in, we were talking about Rebecca's Time Out moment. Rebecca, by this time, now you're age 17, and you had another Time Out moment where you were attacked by some drug dealers. Can you explain to us about that period of time of your life?
Yes. At that point, I was still into drugs and just trying to bury anything in my past. And I had been in a relationship with, you know, some of my friends that I was dealing with or that I was buying from. And one night, they came over to my house, my drug dealer and another one also. And I ended up being raped that night. And from that, it's just, it was just like, as I was saying, it was another thing that just kind of added to the list. And at that point, I didn't even know how to go about it because I was involved in illegal activity with drugs. And so how was I to report something like that? Oh, and so, and just knowing that, okay, that's another thing that's just going to have to be silent and laid there. And,
So did you go to the hospital afterwards, or did you tell anyone at this time? Obviously, you're 17, so did you have a best friend that you could confide in at this time?
Yes, I did have a best friend. I told a lot of even some of the past events and the trauma. I would tell her a little bit about it, but I wouldn't ever have the strength to talk about it. And with this event, I was a little more open because it was present, and I was a little more equipped at the age of 17 rather than at the age of 5, 6, or 7 to deal with that. And so I told her, but I was even going to the counselor at that time, and I, in and out of treatment centers for the eating disorder, and I still told no one. And I didn't go to the hospital. I didn't get anything checked out. It was just, that's what it was, and that was the lifestyle I was in, and so it was just kind of, that's kind of what went along with it in my mind.
Wow. So if you were in treatment centers for your eating disorder, but you still hadn't told anyone, did you check yourself in these centers for help? Or by this time, your parents are noticing that their child is completely different at this time and they made you go? What was the situation?
It was more, I remember being just before my 17th birthday, actually, it was before my senior year in high school, my parents gave me an ultimatum. There was either do this or you're out. Because of the lifestyle, I was having drug dealers come over to my house, you know, and as a teenage girl, and having parties and all that kind of things. And so they gave me a choice. Well, you have to do this. And I was already in counseling, but that was obviously not cutting it. I was getting more and more severe, not only with the eating disorder, but also with the drugs and the alcohol that I was involved in and the social circle then. And so my parents, that year, before my senior year, I was 17 years old, and they shipped me out to a treatment center in Arizona for eating disorders and substance abuse. And I mean, I would go in there for about 3 months there, and then I came back and just started the whole cycle again. I felt like I would get some kind of semblance of, you know, getting a stability, but it just couldn't behoove me. It was just out of my reach, and I would just completely stumble as soon as I came back into the same environment that I was in, the same environment that the trauma was at, the same environment where my friends were still, and I mean, and you know, the abuse had happened, and it was just extremely difficult to sever myself from that. And yes. So
at this time, was your best friend, was she also doing drugs?
It wasn't until about that age. At first, we both started off playing ball together, and we were close because we were on different softball teams and just traveling all the time together, doing travel ball. And so my best friend, she wasn't originally into drugs because of our sports and our future in sports and our aim to go to college and our aspirations to be athletes. And so she was very resistant against that. But then, you know, over time, she just grew more and more into the same social drugs and drinking that I did, and actually further, which, you know, it pains my heart now, but, you know, it just led to both of our destruction in that area.
Right. So did you have any friends who weren't into drugs that would try to, you know, talk to you or, you know, persuade you to do differently?
Yes.
And how did you
yes.
respond to those friends?
Well, I even had friends. I had, like, a friend who was a pastor's daughter, and she would try to coordinate things with me, and I would have a group of friends. I had many different groups of friends, ones that were athletes, ones that were into drugs, because, you know, a lot of times they're not into both, and athletes are trying to better their bodies. And but then I would have some social circles, and even I would show up at church, and I would have youth group friends. But even sometimes the youth group friends would go out and party with me also and drink with me too. And so
wow.
it was just this hypocrisy that was just in front of my eyes. But it so my friends, a lot of times I would drag them in. I feel like I was more of a leader in that aspect than a follower. And they were trying to help me, but it was just, I think it was just too much for them to do just a rescue mission for me. And it, in reality, they can't. They couldn't have. And a person is not capable of that. And, you know, and I found that only the Lord can do that too. Only the Lord brought me out of that. And
right.
I know that's the reason why I'm in ministry today, and that's the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing today, because I realize that. And so I did have friends at the time that were, you know, walking out good lifestyles and were not involved in drugs and alcohol, but at the end of the day, it just wasn't
right.
enough.
So at this time of your life, did you like yourself? Like when you looked in the mirror, did you, you know, were you still just kind of young and partying and, you know, just going on with the flow? Or when you looked in the mirror, did you feel like, I do not like what I see?
If I feel that's part of the reason why I just kept going and going, doing sports and doing activities and, you know, being on four different teams at once and doing this and that and having a full class load and going off into college later, I feel like because I couldn't stand the idea of sitting by myself and looking and evaluating my life. I didn't want to take that time out, I guess. I didn't want to do that. I despised myself so much when I sat down and, you know, that actually, the times that I was alone by myself, those were the times that I tried to kill myself, the times that I tried to cut myself and harm myself because I could not stand the life that I was living and the choices that I'd made and, you know, to my destruction. And, like, even for cutting, for instance, I don't know if you wanted me to go into that, but
I do.
It just, yes, it just, for instance, I part of the reason for cutting was because of, I realize now, just the shame that I felt, the of self-hatred and self-loathing, that if I somehow had this nastiness in me, maybe I could just get it out somehow, or if I could get the emotion out of it, out of me, and all the anger and the pain, that I could get it out of me, or and try to express it in some way. And I think a lot of it had to do with the shame that I had because I wanted to hurt myself. I wanted to. I didn't like the things that were coming out of me, so I wanted to destroy it. And I knew that, you know, there had to be a price for something. I wanted to punish myself. I wanted to do something to try to repay what I had done, even before the Lord, because I was in and out of church. I was doing these things, and I wanted to somehow make a retribution, make repayment, and do penance, and it wasn't, it was futile. It really was.
Wow. So was that the only way that you tried to commit suicide, was through cutting, or did you try some other methods, pills or something like that?
Pills, also overdosing, you know, just pure recklessness. I would do things that were just completely reckless, like driving too fast or going on these crazy car rides with people who were full well drunk and trying to somehow just make an escape, honestly. If I could somehow escape it, and then, you know, I wouldn't have to deal with the repercussions of my life and the shame of my life and the things that I'd done and the things that had happened to me. And so that was kind of what happened and went on for quite some time.
Looking back, Becky, I think for kids, there comes a point in time in their life where they try to hide things and keep things from their parents, but there's always that point in time where they may get in trouble for something, and then they know their secret's out. My parents know that I am a bad kid, or I am a you know, I have life controlling issues, or, you know, my family knows that I have a drinking problem, and then they take a turn for the worse. It's almost as if, well, my parents know that I'm this or that, so then they're no longer trying to hide. They're just, take a turn for the worse. What period of, when did that happen for you? Or was there a period of time that you can recall where you felt like, hey, the cat's out the bag, my parents know that I'm doing this, so I'm just going to, I don't care if they see me smoking or if they see me drinking, I don't care anymore. When did that period of time come for you?
I think part of it, to a degree, came when I was arrested when I was 16. Because that was, you can't hide that. I couldn't hide that. There was, it just was what it was. And then I think a little bit more to where it came, you know, it came when I was like 17, about the point when I could drive and I could go out doing whatever. And that's when my independence struck even further. And it was just, okay, well, I'm going to drink in front of my parents. I'm going to just have people come over and do whatever and do the things that I was doing. And then it got even worse by the time I was 18 and out of the house. That independence thrust me further into more just, well, it is my life. I'm an adult now. And just proving that point by doing even more reckless things and more openly and in that way.
Wow. So for parents that are listening who have, you know, teenage kids, what are some signs that they should look for if their kids are selling or using drugs?
I would have to say,
like, what were some things that changed within you, appearance-wise, habit-wise, personality-wise, that would throw up some red flags for parents?
Just secretive, just being not being as open, I think, and then also money or allowance or anything that they have with a job, if they're having some kind of income, just questionable ways of, okay, well, where's your money going? Seeing those kind of habits, spending habits, and if they're always out of money, even though you just gave it to them, you know that something's up. You know that, okay, it's going in a wrong direction. And I mean, for kids who have jobs, that's a little bit different to kind of track their income. But and then also their grades, I would have to say, and just their evaluate the areas of life. And I would say particularly their friends. Who are they hanging out with? Because if they're bringing people over and you're hearing, I mean, you can just sit in the car and just listen to a conversation while carpooling. You'll know more about their lives than you would in just sitting them down in front of you, you know. And and so I would say who they're hanging out with, what they're doing. And I would say stay involved. If they are involved in sports and activities and in different groups, I the likelihood of them going in that direction of drugs and alcohol, there's a far lesser chance because of there's not as much time. There isn't as much idleness to get into trouble, to do sinful things. And so I would just track those things. Those are namely the top things
right.
that come to mind.
So if someone is suicidal, what, like when you were suicidal, what did you need to hear from a friend or a family member? Like what did you need from them at that time? Or was there nothing no one could say to make you change your mind about that?
I really don't think that at that point that there was something that someone could say. I mean, I was in relationships and they would, you know, tell me, you know, that like you're of so much value, you're so much worth to me. But at the end of the day, that did not, it felt like it would just bounce off of me. It was like when I had the issues with eating also, it was quite similar because someone would tell me I'm beautiful again and again and again. I would love to hear it, but at the end of the day, it did not strike the core issue. I mean, the alcoholism, the cutting, the suicidal attempts and thoughts, and those were just the fruit of the root inside of what needed to be touched. And I knew, and so that it's a totally different thing. When you see those things in someone, it is, that's just, the outworking of a greater, deeper issue, and you're trying to aesthetically get rid of the outside things, even when you come and you speak to someone who has a life-controlling issue, you can't just say, all right, don't do that anymore. Don't do that anymore and
right.
try to correct
right.
the outward posture of it. It's a total heart issue. It's something on the inside that needs to be ministered to. And I found it really is. It's a work of God that, and you have to know for yourself, too, because someone can tell you something and it'll bounce right off of you. And I found that at the end of the day, only when I knew the truth of that, I was not worthless. I was not ugly. I was not beyond repair. When I knew mm-hmm. those things firsthand from biblical things that said that and to Jesus convincing my heart of that, I knew. It just began the process of healing for me.
Now, we're going to get to the root cause in just a minute, but you got a scholarship to play sports. What school did you go to and what sport was that for? Because you played, you know, different sports.
Yes. I got a scholarship to Eastern University just outside Philadelphia, and I was playing softball there for that sport. It was kind of a really hard decision for me, but I went and I played ball, and one of the major reasons that I did that was actually because the coach, while I was in treatment, he stayed connected with me, and he, the year before I graduated high school and went into college, he would just call and check on me and see how I was doing, because he knew that I was struggling with issues. He knew firsthand, but it was just like I saw so much light and hope in him and just the way that he responded to me, and I wanted to go to that school. And so I went to Eastern. I began my education there. I still wasn't even sure what I really wanted to do, honestly. And and that actually brought me, I ended up having to take a break from school and just kind of reevaluate things. That was another time out in my life, honestly. And reevaluate what I wanted to do, what my life was doing at this point, and what it would look like in the future if I kept going like this. And I knew that it wasn't going to go very far. I knew that I was coming to my end if I did not change things quickly. So
what did you major in, may I ask?
I did general studies at first, and then I was doing special education.
Oh, okay. So you took a break from school. Were you at that time still drinking, still cutting, still bulimic at times? Was that the reason for you taking a time out from school?
Yes, actually. My weight had, I guess with the school load, my weight and the anxiety went up of that kind of lifestyle I was in, and I had to take a break. I had to come home. I was having panic attacks. I had tried to kill myself at school, and I needed to take a break. I needed to come home, and even after taking a break and being back in New Jersey where I'm originally from, it just got further worse. I tried to run here and there, trying to run away from the real issues that were at hand, the real things. I thought maybe if I change the setting, then my life will change. If I change this, the outward things, then, you know, I'll be fixed. I'll be better. Like, I'll be able to eat new food normally. I'll be able to exercise like a normal person. I'll be able to do all these things normally. And the reality was I was having those core issues again.
Talk about your transition into college. Did you get along with your teammates? Did they know about your issues? And were they drinking too, or were they alienating you because of some of the things that you were doing?
A lot. My first year, I didn't really want to connect with people that much. So on the team, like, I connected here and there, but even then I was still coming home on the weekends to hang out with my friends that were partying, because I was at a Christian college, and I was not walking with the Lord. And so I didn't connect so much with my team, and until later, it was my second year back at school, and it was the fall semester, and that's when I started connecting. But some of the girls definitely knew about the eating issues, and I was partying with them too. So if I wasn't doing the eating issues with them, it was one thing or the other. And so that's kind of what we connected around, partying at college and doing that. And that's what most of my relationships were built off of. And and it wasn't fruitful. It wasn't good.
So you told me prior to this interview that at age 19, God delivered you. So talk about, you know, how you could go through so many things and then just be delivered from those things.
Well, it was, to me, I am still stunned by it. I mean, it's still a daily choice, but I mean, I was home from Christmas break from school, and my mom, she was a prayer warrior. She would constantly be praying for me, and during Christmas, she actually would stick Christian books in my stocking and et cetera, and give me gifts. And so one night I was up and I was just reading one of these books, and the Lord came and began to speak to me. I had never thought that anyone would ever speak like that, God could speak to people at that point. But from that point on, I knew that I had to choose whether or not I was going to live this lifestyle. And the Lord delivered me. There's no other way I could do it, because I no longer even had the desire to drink. I was just sitting there in my room. I was broken. I was completely just barren before the Lord. I didn't want to go out and party anymore. I didn't want to hang out with anybody anymore. I'd shut off. I had even tried to kill myself, and it was just futility after futility and running into those things, those walls. And it's like, okay, God, if you're not going to let me get out of this life, you got to reorder this. You got to make me actually live and give me something to live for, because at that point I was completely done. All the resources and everything that I'd searched out, I'd done the drinking, I'd done the partying, and nothing would get rid of the pain that was inside of me. Nothing would get rid of the hatred that was inside of me for other people and for myself. And I just cried out to the Lord, and he met me. And from that point on, my desires shifted. I gave myself to the Lord. I said, all right, if I can't do this life, if this is what my life looks like with me running it, I don't want it anymore. I don't want it. And so I gave myself to the Lord, and he directed me from there on out to go to Kansas City to transfer schools. And I didn't desire alcohol. I didn't desire drugs. After treatment, after treatment, after treatment center, there was no way that, you know, I thought that I would ever be out of that. They told me that I would be an alcoholic. They told me I would be bulimic. They told me I would have issues with eating disorders and self-hatred for the rest of my life. That was my diagnosis. But from there on out, I did not drink. I did not desire it. I did not want it. From there on out, the process in healing and restoration for the eating began. But the drinking, the drugs, that was ixnay. It was done. It was done that night, December 29th, 2008. It was done. And so that's kind of from there on out. I began my walk with Jesus for real this time. I wasn't holding anything back, because I knew at the end, if I did not follow him, if I did not go this route, then there was no life. I experienced it. I tasted what life would be like, and it was the end. I knew it was just two roads diverging here. I was either going to live or die, and I had to choose. And so I chose, all right, what do you have for this life, Lord? I want to live. And
wow.
That began the end.
So what do you think was the root cause revealed to you? What was the root cause of everything that happened to you over the course of your life? Like, what were you searching for?
I was searching for a lot. I was searching for justice. I was searching for healing. I was searching for my identity. I was searching for hope somewhere. I was searching for life. I was searching for purpose. I was searching for beauty. All these things wrapped up into one, and at the end of the day, it came down to Jesus. It really did. It came down to me knowing him, and to him knowing that one day he's going to judge. He's going to judge. He's not just going to let it go. You know, he's not going to let it go that I was a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, that I was that little girl that had been traumatized, that those things had happened. There is going to be a day, and that man is going to stand before Jesus. And if he doesn't repent, he's going to be judged for it. And so knowing that there's a man that's going to give me justice. No other man, no other judicial system is going to give me justice for the things and repayment for the things in my life that I thought I was victim to. And actually having a way out of that and having justice come forth in a man, in Jesus, and then having it be real justice, even, you know, and finding real beauty and an mm-hmm. identity that I really have before him, that I'm valued, that I'm not some piece of trash that was to be used by this man and this and that. I was not to be passed along, but I was treasured by the Lord. I just, mm-hmm. it just began to melt every wall that I had built up over time. Mm. Reading this and figuring it out in my heart, I just fell more and more in love with Jesus, and that he could give me a new life after every single mistake that I had made, even mm-hmm. killing my own child, that he could give me a new life. That was the most beautiful and precious thing to me. And
wow.
no other man, woman, or child could give that to me. And the mercy that he just drenched me in was just amazing. And he didn't see like any other man. And so that's kind of my story.
So do you think, looking back over the course of your life, do you think, obviously when you were 4 years old, you know, the tragedy happened when you were molested, but do you think the course of your life could have been differently had you been able to get some counseling, get some things corrected in your mind to know that it wasn't your fault, you were violated, you know, this is someone else's problem and crime that they did against you. Do you think that would have helped you?
I think that would have helped me at that point. I mean, it really would have. And, you know, I've had to deal with that, with not opening my mouth and not letting people know out of fear. But at this point, it's just something I had to lay down. I just...
Right. And I'm not blaming you. You were 4 years old. But for any
yeah.
listener who's out there who, you know, who's dealt with this or maybe dealing with this with a small child, it's beneficial to get them some counseling and get them some help so that they can
Absolutely.
Deal with this early, so that it doesn't
Absolutely.
Follow them throughout the course of their lives, and they're searching their whole lives for justice, for healing, for identity, and some
yes.
of the things that you were crying out for or trying to discover
mm-hmm.
along the way in your own little way. And I
mm-hmm.
think that our filters are developed between the ages of 3 and 5.
Yes,
and so
absolutely.
Whatever happens to you during that time, you view the world through the lenses of that filter
mm-hmm.
for the rest of your life. And
yes.
so if there's something traumatic that happens during those periods between 3 and 5, I think it has to be corrected through counseling or through something. You know, it has to be corrected in that child's mind
mm-hmm.
so that they can
yes.
live a productive life, I believe. Let me ask you this, Becky. Have you forgiven the people that violated you?
Yes. That was a very, very difficult process. And I say it was a process because it did not happen overnight. I did not want to in the least forgive them, let alone, you know, the Bible tells me to bless my enemies. I just thought that was ludicrous. And
mm-hmm.
But it was a very difficult process, and I've learned to forgive, but forgive does not mean does not mean the same thing as reconciliation either. I have to make
mm-hmm.
that clear too, because forgiveness, you may forgive someone from your heart, but reconciliation means, you know, being in relationship with that person. And I would
mm-hmm.
say for a child to be in relationship again, no, absolutely not. I'm saying you forgive.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean it didn't happen. It doesn't mean you pretend it didn't happen. It very well did happen to me, but I've forgiven him. He, the people that did that to me, I've forgiven them. I give them what they do not deserve, and that's mercy, because I've received mm-hmm. the same from the Lord. I've been given something that I do not deserve. Absolutely
right.
do not deserve what I have right now. And having that revelation and having that experience and seeing that mercy and knowing it firsthand enabled me to forgive those men
mm.
and the people that did that to me in my life.
Wow, that's a powerful statement. You give to your predators or the people that violated you what they do not deserve, which is mercy, which is the same thing that, you know, God gives to you. Here's the more important question. Have you forgiven yourself for the life controlling issues, for, you know, all the things that you've done over the course of the years? Have you forgiven yourself?
Yes, that may have even been harder, honestly. That may have been the hardest one. Mm-hmm. And that I have. And that was kind of the last strand, because that was like the thread that broke it all, that broke open that freedom that I was able to walk into. Because that was a deep root of the self-hatred that I had, the self-loathing, and the things that I was doing, those cycles of addictions and all those things that I was in. That was a major factor in it. And I finally forgave myself just this year when I was 23 years old. And I forgave mm-hmm. myself, and I let myself go. And into, right. you know, into what I was holding myself back by not forgiving myself. I was
right.
just repeating those things and those memories in my head and trying to bludgeon myself with them and trying to live up and perfect the standard. I was still doing the same things. And until I forgave myself, only was I able to move forward and actually make something beautiful out of the ashes that I was walking in. Only
mm-hmm.
then could it really be turned into something that was life-giving.
Right. There's a quote that I love that says, "To forgive someone is to set a prisoner free, only to realize that prisoner was you." And so it's very important that you forgive others, but more importantly that you forgive yourself so that you can move on and not punish yourself for what happened in the past, and even be able to look forward and not live the rest of your life looking through a rearview mirror. There's a reason why the windshield is so much bigger than a rearview mirror, because you're
Absolutely.
Meant to look forward. And not backwards through a small little window or glass. So, do you know what your calling is? Like, why do you think God allow you to survive suicide, alcoholism, drug addictions, rape, cutting, all these things that you survived? You know, was to no avail. What is your purpose in life? What were you put on this earth for? Do you know?
Yes, actually I've just been, this verse has been on my mind all day, and I've just been saying it and thinking about it, and it's Isaiah 61. "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and opening the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of the vengeance of our God, and to comfort all who mourn." And it's beauty for ashes, it goes on. And there is freedom in this lifetime. I thought I was going to be a bondage to the events that happened to me in my life and the things that I chose for the rest of my life. I thought I was a victim. But the truth is that Jesus today is alive and well. He rose out of the grave, that I could walk in freedom today, that I don't have to be captive to those things, that I don't have to live my life in light of my choices or some other man, but I live in light of his choice to die on that cross. I live in light of his choice to come as a man in the flesh. And so doing that, and it's to proclaim liberty to prisoners of all different life-controlling issues, to women and children that have been abused or neglected, and or even just in any type of pain. I mean, no one is immune to pain, and but to women and men in life-controlling issues. I mean, even last night, I just ran into a man who was struggling with self-harm. And so just ministering to him and declaring to him that, you know, the truth of the gospel, that Jesus came, that he doesn't have to punish himself for his sins anymore. There's a man that bled for him. He doesn't have to cut himself anymore. There's a man that truly bled for him. And so just declaring that to prisoners and declaring that to men and women, and so that's what I'm called to do.
Wow, I'm listening throughout the course of the show, and when we started the show, when you talked about, you know, some of the things that you went through, your voice was cracking a little bit, more soft-spoken, but now that we're talking about your calling and what you're called to do, I hear a boldness, you know, like you spoke that boldly, and you could go on and elaborate about it, so I can tell that you're in a good space now, and that it matters to know what you're put on this earth for, you know. And sometimes, you know, you get little pieces to a puzzle, and just to look at one piece of the puzzle, it doesn't make sense to you. It's just like, where does this piece fit? Why am I going through this? Why does this have to happen to me? But once you know what you're called to do, what you were put on this earth for, like what your purpose is that only you uniquely can do, it's as if someone gave you the box to the puzzle, because your puzzle's still not completed. You know, you still have to live the rest of your life, so the puzzle's not finished. But when you know what you're called to do and what your purpose is, it's as if someone gives you the box to the puzzle, the cover of it, and now you can see, oh, this is a picture of trees in the fall, you know? And so you understand now, you know, you can start to piece the puzzle together a little bit in bits and pieces, because you at least have a box to see, you know, where each piece goes, or at least what area. You know, there's the orange part of the puzzle, and there's the blue part of the puzzle, there's the red part. So you could gather all the red pieces up and all the green pieces and all the blue pieces. And so, you know, it's a beautiful thing when you learn what you're put on this earth to do. And then you don't have to waste any more time doing something other than that. You can get busy doing what you were put on this or what you were created to do. So I want you to, if we had someone listening on this call today, and we do, we have a lot of people online, we have some people who have called in, but if there's a listener who's struggling with drug addiction, who's struggling with the eating disorder, who feels like there's no hope, that they will always be bound by their addictions, that they're not worthy of love, that they're, you know, just they're low on self-esteem, I want you to speak to them right now. What would you say to them right now?
I would say that you have a purpose that no man or woman can steal that from you. God has divinely placed you on this earth for such a time as this. And that choosing Him, to follow Him, to give you vision, He is able to restore the most broken and desperate places that no man or woman can restore. He is the God of the impossible. Open up your heart to Him. He is able to bring retribution. He is able to deliver. He is able to bind those broken places up and to restore those broken breaches and repair and restore. He restores hundredfold. He just doesn't give back a little bit. He gives back more than you can imagine if you first give Him your heart and you give Him your mind, you give Him your life. If you lay it down, He's able to give you a new one. He's able to deliver you. He's able to walk you, even if it is a process, He's able to walk you through it. And you're not alone. Right now, you're not alone.
You're listening to Rebecca Horan. Rebecca, I just want to thank you for being on the show tonight, for being so transparent with your story. I believe you have helped a number of people tonight just sharing your story. And I think when you share your story, you bless other people, and ultimately you set yourself free by speaking your testimony and sharing it with others. So I thank you for that. I just want to encourage you in your ministry to help other at-risk kids or people with life-controlling issues to be encouraged. I know it's not easy work. It's very difficult work. Sometimes you may not have the words to say to them, just as you felt like no one could say anything really to you. But I just want to encourage you in what you're doing. I commend you. I think it's very obvious to me, and probably to our listeners, that the reason why you've been fought so hard throughout your entire life is because of the huge ministry that you have and the great number of people that you will be able to touch and bless and speak life into, like you just did tonight. This is Sylvia Crowley with Time Out. This is our time. I've run out of time. We will see you next week, same time, same place. And I want to leave you with two things that Rebecca said that I think are actually tweetable and just, you know, noteworthy. She said that I don't have to live my life in light of my past choices. I can live in God's light. She also said, I give to my violators something that they do not deserve and something that God has given to me, and that's mercy. Take a time out.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you want to go, what you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Wait, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, take your time
to ride. Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz. But you moving kinda fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.